This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with a private pilot who developed an electronic logbook and started his own company. In the news, FAA releases the final Part 23 rule for GA airworthiness standards. Diamond Aircraft has attracted the attention of the Chinese. Cessna puts an end to an LSA. A study of airline pilot depression, flight attendants learn self-defense, and Airbus thinks plug-and-play for cabin modules. All that and more coming up right now.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks. This is episode 432 of the show where we talk aviation. Of course, now, if you're a new listener, we want to welcome you all. Of course, each episode, we bring a number of our co-hosts together with a notable guest and talk about aviation through a variety of segments. I'm Rob Mark, senior editor at Flying Magazine, also a flight instructor and publisher of the Jetwine blog. But I'm joined by a few pals here. And with me first is our producer and audio guru, Max Flight. Max, are you with us?
I am. I'm on the wrong side of the opening, but it feels strange. But keep going, Rob. You're doing well.
And I think I can make it to the next one as well. So we have another CFI on board tonight. Max Trescott, an author and a glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, are you with us from the West?
I am here. Boy, I feel like this is like an alternate reality or parallel universe or something. It's fun to be on the other side of the looking glass here. Hey, I want to tell you, I spent hours today at San Jose International Airport to watch something special. And I'll tell you guys later what I saw. Folks on Twitter have already seen the photos I sent.
Will it have something to do with that alternate reality?
No, something to do with airplanes.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we can handle that. So, but hey, listen, what would our show be without an aviation historian like David Vanderhoof, who was off last week because he was flued out? And David, are you with us and better?
Yes and yes. I apologize. I caught whatever Max had a couple of weeks ago.
We passed it through Skype, I guess.
Yeah, something like that. So, I'm back, looking forward to our last show of 2016. I don't know where 2016 went, actually.
Yeah, I don't either. It's hard to believe we're talking about the last show. But, hey, listen, how could we possibly have a last show without our associate producer, Brian Coleman, also out in the West in beautiful Pasadena? Brian, are you with us?
Hey, Rob. Yes, I'm here. Hopefully this is not the last show. I'm doing my part to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I thought it was really funny today. I was talking with a customer and, you know, of course, the weather has to come up. And I said, yeah, it's freezing here in Southern California. And they said, what, did it make it down into the 40s? And I said, no, it was 62. So I got absolutely no sympathy for that whatsoever.
Yeah, this is why we hate you.
One of many reasons.
My daughter came home just in time from Los Angeles the other day to hook up with the 10 below zero that we had in Chicago. So she's already decided when she graduates in the spring that she's going to stay out there for a while, I think.
Yeah, she's moving back, huh?
Yeah, well, I can't say as I blame her. So, but hey, listen, our guest this episode is a friend of a friend. Our old pal Ducky, Dave Allen, down in Florida, brought us together with Ken Viard, who's the founder of PilotPartner.net, the electronic pilot logbook that we're all going to hear more about here in a little bit. And Ken's a private pilot with an instrument rating and more than 750 flying hours. And he owns a Beach Bonanza turbocharged type, and I'm really jealous. And Ken, welcome to the Airplane Geeks.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's good to be with you guys.
Well, so much for that. Now we're going to get into the hard stuff. Well, that'll be the news, but we're going to talk about pilot logbooks and pilot partners specifically here in just a little bit. But as I said, I think we need to get through some. We've got a lot of news tonight, so I think we better get cooking. And is everybody ready?
Ready. Ready from the parallel universe.
Yeah, I'm the dark side on this part of the world.
And I'm ready.
I think when we get to the news, Max, I'm going to throw it back to you because I'm exhausted from this stress. So, heck, let's get to the news, guys.
All right, here we go. Thanks, Rob, for opening up the show again. First item comes from FAA. This is actually a press release. FAA issues final rule on small airplane safety certification standards. Now, this is a new Part 23 rule that the FAA's issued. It overhauls the airworthiness standards for small GA airplanes. The rule establishes performance-based standards for airplanes that weigh less than 19,000 pounds or with 19 fewer seats. Now, again, this looks at consensus-based compliance methods, standards, for specific designs and technologies, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Now, the FAA believes this rule will reduce the time it takes to move safety-enhancing technologies for small airplanes into the marketplace, and also that it will reduce costs. So I think this has been generally well-received and seen as something good and positive for general aviation. Rob, what do you think about that?
Oh, I don't see how it couldn't be. I mean, we've been dealing for years with people out there inventing cool stuff that would be a boon to aviation safety, but then they get bogged down with the process of trying to make it fit into the into certified aircraft, which didn't have the equipment originally, and FAA seems to have just really slowed that process down to a point where even the FAA couldn't stand it any longer. So I think this is going to be quite a great thing. Take angle of attack indicators, for instance. I mean, it's a great safety piece of technology, but it was harder than heck to get that thing into an airplane that was already certified. And so this is going to make it much easier, I think. And in the end, I think we're going to hope that it really helps reduce accidents, which is what this is all about.
Adding to safety and reducing costs, I guess it doesn't get too much better than that. Ken, is this something that you think will affect you directly or, you know, as a pilot, as a GA pilot, or something that's a little bit more indirect?
I absolutely hope that this is going to be the start of something really great that the FAA is doing. I watched the entire press conference the other night on YouTube, and I've never been more excited to hear a Bourne press conference in my entire career. I think that the FAA is actually on a roll between Part 107 and the unmanned world that they did earlier, and then followed up with a Part 23 rewrite that actually makes sense and embraces innovation and new technology coming out quicker and easier. It's a whole different FAA that I'm just not used to dealing with, and I'm really excited to see what's going to happen, and I really think the future is bright for general aviation with this.
Max Trescott, any downsides you can see to this?
No, I don't think so. I would think there will always be some unintended consequences. There might be, you know, some little flaws in it that they'll have to fix over time. But I think the idea of moving away from telling people how they have to do things to telling them, you know, what performance these things have to deliver really frees people up to, you know, not have to use old methods, you know, to meet a design criteria, but to, you know, incorporate new methods provided they're as strong and as safe. So, yeah, this is a great move.
All right, well, let's move on to item number two here, and this comes from AvWeb. Diamond Aircraft reportedly sold to Chinese interests. This is a little bit of a breaking story, I guess, as we record this, because there really isn't a lot of coverage of this. But reportedly, the Chinese conglomerate Wenfang Auto Holding Group has purchased Diamond Aircraft. Now, at the time of the article, AvWeb couldn't confirm the details of the sale and whether or not it includes the entire company or just a part of it or what. They do note that Diamond has had a position in China for more than a decade, has a manufacturing facility there. Wenfeng is, of course, based in China. They have aircraft manufacturing, but also robotics and financial services as part of the business portfolio. It's kind of a typical Chinese conglomerate. So we're not entirely clear, are we, that this has taken place or what the scope is? It's kind of strange that there isn't much press coverage.
Yeah, the story's been changing a little bit. At first, there was a very, very short announcement by AvWeb. They then updated that story the following day, and what they said was that instead of purchasing the whole company, which they couldn't confirm initially, it's really just the Canadian operation of Diamond for which a 60% share has been sold. So I talked, I exchanged messages today with a friend of mine that works in that London, Ontario operation. And he basically thought that it was essentially a cash infusion. That's about all I got out of it. Taking a look at what that operation does, that's been the home of the Diamond D-Jet development. And the D-Jet has been kind of cash challenged. They originally got about $20 million investment around 2010, and they had a promise from the local government for another $35 million contingent upon the federal Canadian government coming up with yet another $35 million. The feds did not come through, so they didn't get that $70 million. And so in 2014, they announced that the D-Jet was not canceled but put on hold. So my guess, and that's really all this is, I don't have any inside information on this, is that maybe this will allow them to start hiring people back on the D-Jet program again.
Interesting.
Kind of like they did with the Cirrus Vision Jet when the Chinese bought that.
Yeah, there's remarkable parallel between the two stories.
No, I just would have thought that they would have had an announcement on their website, on either company's website. And who knows, maybe this is such breaking news that it'll show up tomorrow or the next day.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because I only heard about it because I have a source in the industry that feeds me these kinds of news tips occasionally. And Max T, thanks for that, as a matter of fact.
And have a lot of fun during the week kind of sorting through all these little bit tidbits, before we do the show. So, yes, you're welcome.
Yeah, because Max actually sent me a text or something last night and said, hey, what's happening with that Diamond sale? And I went, huh? And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, boy, I didn't know anything about that. Neither did anybody else, really. But what I did find today on the Diamond Aircraft GmbH site over in Austria, the European parent company, is that it is just, as Max said, the Canadian subsidiary that the stock was sold from. They still have the main company in Austria that also builds the engines, staying 100% Austrian, as they say. And I agree with Max, it's cash infusion to get some other projects going. And I'll bet you we will see that D-Jet come back pretty soon.
Yeah, it was interesting. As we talk, it's now been 6 days since a Chinese website that we found, mentioned that this had happened. And so you'd think that all the press sources would be on it by now, but it's like, well, not so.
Yeah, this was from China Radio International's English service, this Chinese website. They actually show a photograph of what they say is the handover ceremony to acquire, quote-unquote, Diamond Aircraft Industries in Canada. Dated December 13th. So that actually predates the AvWeb story.
Well, it was something that I was surprised at, too, though, in terms of the quiet sale, I guess, is that, I called the Diamond folks a couple of times today up in Canada, and they did not return phone calls. And I also talked to Gamma, the Aircraft Manufacturers Association, at the Washington office, and Diamond's a member of Gamma. They didn't call back. And I said, well, it's not terrible, but it's a little strange. It's just a little odd that, again, when something like this happens, that everybody, or really nobody, really wants to talk about it.
Hmm. Well, we know that the Chinese really want to build up their general aviation infrastructure, business aviation, and so forth. And we've seen them take a lot of actions that would suggest they're going down that path. This is consistent with that, if this is what's going to be happening. And we probably will see more of this sort of thing in the future, don't you think?
Boy, what's left? You know, they've got Cirrus, they've got Continental Engines, they've got a good chunk now of Diamond. So what's left, I guess, is Cessna and Textron. So,
well, there's Piper. Oh, no, yeah. Piper's already owned by the Middle East somewhere, isn't it?
Well, speaking of Cessna, we have another article in AvWeb. This is Cessna scraps unsold Skycatchers. Now, I guess they've been able to or unable to make a commercial success of their 162 model Skycatcher light sport airplane. And Cessna has actually started scrapping the remaining inventory of those airplanes. What happened with the Skycatcher?
Boy, you know, I think it's just it's unfortunately has not been successful in the market. Nice technically aircraft, but market failure. I think part of the problem was they started selling them for around $110,000, and then the price suddenly jumped up to, I think, $149,000. And what had been, I think, about 1,000 orders suddenly shrank, and they ended up only selling just under 200 aircraft before discontinuing it. So really, really kind of sad.
Yeah, Max T, how does that pricing compare with other light sport aircraft?
I would say it's in the ballpark. It might be slightly on the high end, but it's certainly, you know, it's not outrageously different from other LSAs.
Yeah, so therefore you wouldn't think the pricing would be the reason why they saw such a dramatic drop off in sales.
Yeah, but maybe the expectations. People thought they were going to get an airplane for slightly more than $100,000 and then dropped out when they found it was $150,000. I just don't know. I've flown it a couple of times. What was unique about it was that rather than having a stick or a yoke, it had what they called the stoke, which was a handle that projected out from underneath the bottom of the instrument panel. And I got to tell you, I found that as a primary flight control was not as easy to use as either a stick or a yoke, simply because your whole arm was suspended in space. It's not like you were resting it on anything. And so it was a little difficult to do very small, fine, you know, movements on it, I thought. But, you know, others may feel differently about it.
And I think they're not scrapping all of the unsold Skycatchers. I think they're keeping some for spare parts for the future. But I have to tell you, looking at that photograph of Skycatcher airframes being dropped into a big dumpster, it's just heart-wrenching to see that, you know?
It sure is.
Reminiscent of when they scrapped all the Starships a couple of, what was it, a decade ago or 15 years ago? I forgot when it was. But they get to a point where they don't want any liability. And the only way to ensure that is to axe them all.
Mm. Yeah, it is gut-wrenching, though, to see a fuselage, in the what looks like vice grips crushing it. it's very sad.
Yeah, yeah. All right, next item. This comes from CNN. Airplane pilot mental health and suicidal thoughts, a cross-sectional descriptive study via anonymous web-based survey.
Now, are you looking at me?
You can see me. Well, this is a study of commercial airline pilots, and it was...
You guys don't like me, do you?
And it was published in Biomed Central. So 3,485 pilots were surveyed. About half of them completed the web-based survey. This was between April and December 2015. And the conclusions were that there are actually hundreds of pilots currently flying that are managing depressive symptoms, they say, without the possibility of treatment due to the fear of negative career impacts. And that's something we've talked about in the past, the feeling amongst some pilots, perhaps, that if they self-report a condition, that it may impact them adversely. But interestingly enough about this survey is they say it's the first study done that's been using data collected outside of accident investigations or things like this. This is, outside of any kind of governmental activity. The report is in some detail and it goes into some stuff that, I don't know, Rob, maybe your wife understands some of this stuff, but it's kind of dense, I think.
Well, I did go through a few bits and pieces of this with her before the show. And for those folks that don't know, my wife's a psychologist, a clinician here in Chicagoland. And, she said that it's I think anybody that has taken any kind of statistics classes will be able to poke holes in any kind of survey that looks at something like mental health, because it is so stigmatized to begin with that it's hard to imagine that the people that are involved that are answering the survey know enough about it to be able to accurately diagnose themselves to begin with. But then, too, there are so many aspects of this that at least the wife clinician says, you might be able to see a symptom or two, but definitively, she said, I can't imagine how they would do that without some sort of in-person interview or some sort of face-to-face conversation with the people involved. So I'm certainly out of my league when it comes to people in this situation. But of course, this all really began after the German Wings crash about 18 months ago,
right?
In which the first officer locked the captain out of the cockpit and pushed the stick over until the airplane hit the rocks. And then we found out all of that information that Lufthansa knew certain things about the pilot that they just kind of said, well, he seems better now, and they brought him back to duty. But here in the States, we don't really have a good program for mental health issues. We do if you were, say, an alcoholic and you're an airline pilot, but mental health issues, boy, those are still toughies to deal with. But this is a start.
Yeah. And I was going to bring up alcoholism as well. Back in the 1970s and 1980s is when things first started to turn around for airline pilots, where they could actually admit that they had a problem, seek treatment without guarantee being fired. And I remember meeting an airline captain probably around the early 80s, who was just in that situation. He had, been allowed to go get treatment. So to me, this is exactly where we were, 35 years ago with the alcoholism. When we found this story last week, I didn't think that it was going to, be as widespread as it has become. I actually saw this on the CBS News Sunday night. So the story has
really
gone. Yeah, exactly. Wow. I just thought that this would be an industry story. I didn't think it would go, mainstream media like that. And what, of course, it did show was that there was kind of a higher percentage of, folks within the airline industry who felt that they had mental issues than in other, a number of other industries that they looked at. So, yeah, definitely something to have on our radar screen and for all of us to be thinking about, even if it's not the definitive story. It's definitely a good starting place to be thinking about these issues.
Yeah, one of the tidbits that I pulled out of this is that it says, among age categories, median total depression score decreased with increasing age quartile. So it was the younger pilots that have greater rates of depression as measured by this survey, which is, I don't know how to interpret that, but I just thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, and certainly those folks are going to be not as well off. Folks that have been flying for 20, 30 years maybe have higher seniority and better compensation and, things like that. But I'm wondering, and Rob, maybe do younger people in general have higher rates of mental illness or depression?
I don't know that for a fact, one way or another. I mean, and I know it sounds kind of crazy, but one thing that did pop into my mind is to look at the look at the stress young people are under these days trying to deal with educational loans. And we're not talking about somebody getting out of school owing $5,000. We're talking about, especially on the aviation side, kids owing tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars, and so that they can, that they're really put in some horrible corners just trying to make ends meet, trying to find a job. Now, I'm not saying there's a correlation there. I'd actually be curious to see if there was. But you know, again, it's not the same world we came into a couple of decades ago.
Well, and here's something that fits with that. I just looked it up, webpage here about major depressive disorder. It says in adults, major depressive disorder affects twice as many women as men. For both genders, it is most common in those who are 25 to 44 years of age and least common for those who are over age 65.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, yeah, this is certainly something to follow. There's a link to this article in the show notes, as is the case with all the articles we talk about. And so if this is a topic that you're particularly interested in or have some experience with this profession that you might want to dive into. But let's move on. A group of people who are kind of taking matters into their own hands, I guess. The flight attendants from the Washington Post. We see flight and fight. Attendants learn self-defense in the air. Now, this is about a TSA program that's actually been around since 2004. It's a voluntary, no-charge, crew member self-defense training program. They've offered that at 20 different sites around the U.S. So far, over 11,000 crew members have participated in this self-defense kind of training. And they don't mess around. The recent class near Dulles was taught by a retired master sergeant from Army Special Forces. He worked also at the Secret Service Training Academy, and now he's with the Federal Air Marshal Service. So I think this is a guy who probably knows a thing or 12 about self-defense. Now, it is free. It's not sponsored. Participants have to take this on their own time, and they pay their own travel expenses. But wow, 11,000 crew have found it valuable to attend this kind of training. That's a big number.
It's quite the story. We pushed a couple other stories out when this one came along just to get it in there because, it's, you know, you hear so many things about what goes on in the air, and I don't remember really hearing about flight attendants taking this kind of training. There's a photo here of a 55-year-old flight attendant who is, you know, learning to, you know, try and get knives out of people's hands and learning about, what do they say, wind chokes, blood chokes, best way to avoid hitting the knuckles, you know, move, block, strike. It's like, wow, it's not the kind of training you usually think of when you think of cabin crew. But I'll tell you one thing, in the future, I'm not going to argue with them.
Yeah, good move. There's some statistics in here, and there's a difference between the U.S. statistics and international statistics. The U.S. statistics show that the number of passengers cited for, quote, unruly behavior has actually been declining. It peaked in 2004 at 310 incidents. And in the first 7 months of this year, 2016, only 31 incidents were recorded. So at least the reports of unruly behavior have gone down in the U.S. But internationally, the numbers are actually increasing. The article says that there was a 14% increase in 2015 over 2014. Also, it notes that about 11% of the incidents reported worldwide involved physical aggression, and that's 11% of 10,854 incidents. So, you know, there are quite a few examples of passengers getting pretty unruly. So, you know, it's kind of unfortunate, but I can see flight attendants benefiting from this kind of training.
I've always said that I think everyone should take some sort of self-defense class, and it's one of those training classes I think you hope that you never have to use, but just in case if a situation comes up, you are able to defend yourself a little bit better than you might have otherwise, and being safer in the air, I'm kind of all in favor of it.
Yeah. We have an item from Skift. This is Airbus wants airlines to radically rethink the passenger experience. Now, we also heard about this from our listener, Ray, and we have an article from Wired.com on this topic. It's Airbus' new jet concept features swappable spas and cafes. So this is the Airbus Transpose concept. That's what it's called, Transpose. And the idea is that it uses swappable plane interiors, so that travelers can be offered everything from restaurants to spas to working spaces, whatever. These are little modules, sort of plug and play little modules. The idea is that cargo planes use this kind of, I don't know if I want to call it technology, but this kind of concept with modules that are fit into the fuselage. So the idea is that, well, maybe you could do the same thing with passenger planes, building on the experience in cargo aircraft. And really, this would become sort of configurable airplanes. Brian, you're in the air a lot. Do you think this is something that makes sense?
It's certainly a novel idea. I just wonder all the other equipment and support structure that needs to be in these pods to move them in and out and secure them, if it's, you know, if it passes that cost benefit analysis. But I certainly think that it's flexible. And the article talked about the reuse of an aircraft. You know, it might be flying a bunch of short haul flights and then being able to reconfigure it for a long haul flight where you might have higher paying passengers that want some of these amenities. It absolutely makes sense because you can't configure a traditional aircraft to support things like better sleeping quarters or gift shops or spas or whatever the airlines come up with that they might put in these spaces. So Airbus has certainly been innovative in coming up with a bunch of pretty cool ways of not only stacking passengers in on the one extreme, but now working on the higher end experience on the other end. So, yeah, I think it's definitely something to look into further.
Hey, Brian, how's this for an idea? While the airplane is sitting on the ground in some distant city waiting for the arrival of the airplane that's going to take these people that will use the pods on the next leg, what if they loaded them into the pods and already had them boarded, and then you just lifted the whole pod into the airplane?
No, I think that that was certainly a thought that Airbus had, what, 2-3 months ago. I think we talked about that story about just having the entire passenger cabin be swapped out. I think that's a little bit more difficult to accommodate, but I don't know. Again, these specially used pods seem to make sense to me. I just don't know if the airlines are willing to give up the seat revenue for them.
I could just see the forklift operator. Oops, we dropped the pod. all the people freeloaded in it.
United drops pods.
Yeah, that's bad.
You guys are so behind the times. Do you know the Air Force has been doing this with C-130s since the 60s?
Well, I was going to ask you about that, David. I was going to ask you that exact question. Is there a precedent for this, or is there a military version of this that's been in use and proven? Sounds like there is.
They're the Airborne Battlefield Command Center was a pod that you loaded in the back of a C-130 that was completely configurable for an airborne command center, where with consoles and seats and everything you need, and all you did was you pushed it into the back of the 130 and you took off. So this is old school technology. This is nothing new.
Wait a minute. Airbus isn't going to do an AC-130 gunship version of their That was a pod too, wasn't it?
Yeah, that'd be fun to fly.
No, AC-130s, well, now they're let me backtrack. The original AC-130 is not a configurable weapons platform. Yeah. However, Harvest Hawk and the Marine Corps now are working on, and the United States Air Force, configurable platforms that can roll on, roll off as gunships. So you'd move the pod into the 130 and you'd have a conventional 130 that would become a gunship. The traditional AC-130s, though, are modified and strengthened to support the cannons, etc. So there is technology out there going that, you know, you just build the pod, it fits inside, and away you go. It's no different than the Sheridan fighting vehicle that the 82nd Airborne used, which was a lightweight tank that was air-droppable. And the reason why the size it was because it sat in the back of a C-130. Hmm. The one airplane came first, the tank came second.
Interesting. Well, we see lots of patents floating by from Airbus, a lot from Airbus, but also some from Boeing. And they look kind of, you know, maybe interesting, maybe crazy, And we're usually pretty convinced that nothing is ever going to become of it. You know, you might think that, well, maybe this is the same. And that's where I started thinking until I read the part where it said that Airbus says they're building a prototype. So this sounds like a concept that's moving way beyond just, you know, a patent on a piece of paper, and they're investing money in something that they think might have value.
You know, one thing that the article didn't really talk about, it did talk quite a bit about how the seat revenue loss and how most airlines may not really want this. But what about the weight cost?
Yes.
Just add in the cargo door to a commercial airliner, that's weight. Add in a second shell of the pod, that's weight. All those different things add up. And, you know, I'm a general aviation pilot, but what I know about commercial, everything's about weight. You save 10 pounds, you save 100 pounds, you save 1,000 pounds, that equals money saved.
It made me think of batteries in the Apple iPhones, right? At one point, or originally, batteries in smartphones were replaceable, but that required, you know, a structure inside and so forth. And if you, you know, eliminate that, if the batteries are not replaceable, you can seal them up. You've got something that's smaller, lighter, and that's an advantage. And Ken, I think you're absolutely right that wouldn't you see a huge weight penalty in a commercial aircraft that employed this kind of an approach?
I argue different.
Okay, go ahead.
Because you're not using, you have weight when you need the weight, not necessarily all the time. Like Brian said, if you're using it for short haul, you have a configurable setup for a short haul, but then you need it for a long haul, you're replacing the weight and you're using it for that mission. You airline people don't understand mission specific weapon systems.
David, this is where I was thinking, instead of doing it on the passenger deck, wouldn't it be interesting to do it on the lower deck and, for example, have sleeping pods there? And you might not need a full 8 feet of height down in the cargo bay, and putting in some sleeping berths might be an interesting thing to do. And the cargo door is already there. They already have the equipment to move containers in and out. So it'd be a much smaller modification, I'd think, in order to do that.
But again, I mean, weight would be based on the mission, not necessarily. The whole point of this is you're not flying around all the time with the high-end interior if you don't need the high-end interior. So, I mean, the weight argument doesn't work because you're carrying what you need at the time, not necessarily what you're gaining the ability to carry the weight that you need at that time, and you don't have to carry the additional weight when you're not needing it.
I think there's just a weight penalty just for the system as a whole. I mean, just the shell and the door is just extra weight, never mind what you put inside of each pod. I think that there's just a weight penalty to get started.
Yeah, so what the net is, that's what kind of counts. So we'll have to watch this one. This will be very interesting. I'd be really curious to see how far Airbus goes with this concept.
Maybe they could have fuel drop tanks. You know, they're going across the Atlantic. Yeah. And we're done with that one. Just drop it off.
Hey, we need new ideas. Let's just slip maybe one little thing in here. Rob, you made a note that the F-4 Phantom final flight is coming up. Is that correct?
I saw that a little earlier today that David is probably the better one to talk about this.
Go ahead, Rob.
No, I don't know much about it. That's why I sent it to you. And I said, boy, it's too bad we don't have time to talk about this. But they said there's still a Phantom 2 operating from a base.
There are 12. They're based at Holloman Air Force Base, and they are QF-4Es.
Oh, that means they want to shoot them down.
They're drones, and the day that we release this will be the last manned missions for these aircraft. They're being retired. They're being replaced with QF-16s. Tyndall Air Force Base back in 2 years ago converted from the Phantom to the QF-16, and now Holloman, which is the West Coast targeting squadron, will also be converting to the QF-16, and their first one of those will be arriving on Wednesday with the retirement of the Phantom. With the retirement of the Phantom to the boneyards, the United States Air Force is out of the Phantom flying business since the early 60s.
Wow.
So it doesn't mean there aren't Phantoms around Turkey, Greece, Japan, but the United States, the Navy retired their Phantoms and their drone program about 10, 15 years ago. So the Air Force was the solitary FSATs, which is a full-scale aerial target, and they will be retiring. The Phantoms were actually, two of the Phantoms were at Oshkosh and Nellis and did a final tour to say goodbye. But yeah, it's going to be kind of sad. We won't have Phantoms anymore except one Collings Foundation civilian one in out of Texas left flying in the United States.
Wow.
See, Rob, you were right. David does know more about this stuff. That's pretty good for off the top of your head.
I was not expecting you to throw it at me. But actually, what quick question about drones. When they use those Phantoms or F-16s or whatever as Q airplanes, I mean, they're not just putting them up there straight and level. I mean, they're doing some maneuvering to make it harder to hit them, aren't they?
It depends upon the mission profile, whatever they're using them as. Yes, they're fully functional aircraft. And yes, they are. The F-16s now are the reason why we've gone to the QF-16As is because of their maneuverability to act as fourth generation fighters. Phantoms aren't as maneuverable, but yes, they it depends upon the mission profile. Sometimes you want them fly straight and level. Sometimes you want them yanking and banking. But then the other part is, for a long time, you want to be able to have the drone come back after it's hit. When we had QF-100s, they had giant rocket pods out on the wings so that the things like sidewinders, which were heat-seeking missiles, would take out the rocket pod and not the whole airplane, to bring it back to base so they could reuse it again. So it depends upon the profile. No, you're not dogfighting these, but we've actually had an F-35 try to take out a Phantom, and believe it or not, the Phantom survived and came home. So that was, but it all depends upon the mission profile.
Interesting.
Cool. Oh, let me tell you something that's also interesting. Do you guys know what Rob was doing during the Airbus story?
I'm afraid to ask.
He was on Twitter.
He was. You got it, too. I got this little beep beep from Jetwine. I'm going, hey, what are you doing? We're doing the
okay,
news,
I'm sorry. I just saw that picture come up, and I thought it was so cool. All right. I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself.
You're busted, buddy.
All right, man. Sorry.
Again, we're talking with Ken Viard. He's president of Pilot Partner, Electronic Pilot Logbooks. Ken, again, thanks for coming on the show. Before we get into some of the details, maybe for the listeners who are not pilots, can you explain what some of the requirements are for pilot logbooks?
And believe it or not, with the FAA specifically, Pilot Partner is useful to other pilots across other agencies, but we specifically target FAA rules, and that's where most of my knowledge comes from. But it's not as well defined as you think it would be. For something as basic and as important as logging your flights is, the FAA doesn't do as clear of a definition of what you should do and what you shouldn't do. The primary reason for flight logs is for documenting your training and your qualifications in a specific for a specific rating, license, or privilege that you want to execute under the FAA. That's where most of the rules are tallied around. But simple things like what is the definition of total time is not clearly defined anywhere in the federal regulations. And things about pilot and command time, time in different aircraft classes and categories, that's more specific. And it, the FAA has all the rules written around the training process. So what's the documented requirements for a private pilot certificate? What is the documented requirements for a commercial license or an instrument rating? Those things are outlined very specifically, but in none of those regulations does it mention the word total time. It will always talk about how much pilot command time you need, how much simulated instrument time you need, things like that. The only reference to total time is in the private pilot certificate, where it says you have to have 40 hours of logged time. But how do you measure total time?
So, Ken, if I look at Rob Mark's logbook and I look at Max Trescott's logbook, are we saying that they might look quite a bit different, or that the data captured in each of those logbooks might be different?
Yep. Every logbook can be customized to your to each pilot. So there is no de facto standard for which columns need to be in a logbook. There is no definition of when Rob logs 1 hour in his airplane and Max logs 1 hour in his airplane, those may not be equivalent hours. Rob may be measuring wheels up into wheels down time. Max may be measuring based upon a Hobbs meter in the airplane, which is effectively measuring how long the engine is running, where I might not have a Hobbs meter in my airplane. I might log off of my tachometer in the airplane, which runs at a different speed than the Hobbs meter. And for most general aviation, there is no set standard for what is a total time.
Yeah, I see this coming up with simulator time. You know, do you include that within the total? And what about dual given, you know, in a simulator as opposed to, you know, receiving time in a simulator? Do you put that in your total column?
Yep. Gets real confusing real quick. So the first thing I always like to talk to people about is, why are you logging your time? And to understand how accurate you want to be and what you want your logbook to look like, you first need to know who you're logging that time for. And there's lots of different answers. People who are going through training, I think, is a very specific and easy one to answer. But once you get your certificates, and maybe you're not looking to make a professional career, there are requirements to log just the minimum flights required to prove your currency. I have talked to so many different pilots, and that means a lot of different things. I know some pilots who say, when I take the plane in for annual, they'll write the tack time down, and that's my logbook. And I scratch my head wondering, if you ever get asked by the FAA after an incident or something like that, how are you going to prove your currency with that minimum log? Ultimately, I feel people are in the general aviation space are logging your time to answer to the FAA in a post-incident environment if you're requested to produce your logbooks. But more importantly, the person you are logging your time for is your insurance company. And the requirements that your insurance company has will vary based upon your experience and the type of airplane that you're flying. The real problem is it won't be an issue until you have bent your airplane up in a field off the airport somewhere and you want them to pay for that airplane, as your insurance policy says, and they'll say, we'll be happy to. Show us that you've met the requirements of your insurance policy. And that's where your logbook becomes important. So you don't want to procrastinate on your logbook, and you don't want to wait until there's an incident to go back and reconstruct that information so you can have your aircraft paid for.
Do the regulatory agencies, Ken, or the insurance companies care if your logbook is paper-based or electronic? Are there special requirements for, you know, either one of those, or are they all indifferent to the format?
And this is something where I think in 2016, going back to the news story that we talked about with part 23, the FAA is on a roll. The FAA published an article in 2016. It was Susan Parsons, who I believe has been a guest on the show before, wrote an article in the FAA safety briefing about electronic logbook and what the FAA stance is on it. And in that article, they clearly say that the regs neither say that you can or you cannot use electronic logbooks. The requirements is that it's accurate and it is legible and it has the information available. And basically, they're saying, we're not going to say, yes, you can use electronic logbooks, but now they're really urging that as a viable alternative. And then if you transition to insurance companies, which I really feel that insurance companies have a greater responsibility for regulating general aviation than even the FAA does. The FAA sets a great baseline of rules and standards that us pilots need to follow in general aviation, but the insurance company is the one who provides more stringent currency requirements and continued education requirements. I recently started flying my friend's 414, and I require an annual checkout in the airplane instead of the FAA required biannual checkout because it's a much bigger, more complex aircraft. So the insurance companies, and I've talked to several different insurance providers in the industry, love electronic logbooks. And I'm pushing a couple of these insurance companies to offer an electronic logbook discount to their pilots, because if you have one pilot on one hand who uses his, well, my tax says I flew 150 hours last year, so that's what I'm going to tell the insurance company, versus a pilot who is breaking down their time into the different categories that you are using and actually using that to drive trends and analysis, is a more detailed oriented pilot who is a safer pilot. And that's something I'm working towards. I haven't gotten any success in getting that to happen yet, but I do have a few guys who see the value in that.
Interesting. Rob, a zillion years ago, when you were first getting started, how did you learn how to do a logbook?
Oh, I'm sorry. A zillion years ago? Were you talking to me?
Well, 50 or 60 anyway.
Okay. Actually,
did he use the chisel against the stone tablet? Sorry, I needed to follow up.
Okay.
It was an opening and you took it, David.
Actually, no. When I started working on my private, you know, years and years ago, I was at a university, and the university had a strict requirement for keeping the logbook. In fact, we had to, you know, the instructor would essentially start every entry, and then the logbook stayed in your records at the airport. And every time you flew with the instructor, he would go over it with you and put the data in. And then once I started flying solo, it was my job to keep it up, because what they wanted to see is, were you indeed making progress? And they could tell that if a bunch of us zero timers all started school September 1st, let's say, by October 1st, weather permitting, you know, generally you should be this particular far along. You know, maybe you were, you'd already soloed or, you know, that sort of thing. And they could compare them. But later in life, when I went on to, you know, get other ratings, it was easy. I mean, you had to be able to prove in order to take the commercial check ride that you had X number of hours in X number of categories. And long before we ever finished, say, commercial pilot certificate training, the instructors would say, let's pull out your logbook and take a look. And I can remember changing out of one logbook to another because I'd made so many mistakes in it. And, you know, it had whiteout on it and all kinds of other stuff, and it looked really bad. And they said, you know, you ought to just really try to make this look a little more professional, because the more professional it looks, the less chance there's going to be for someone to say, where did you get this time from? Or gee, these numbers don't seem to add up or that sort of thing. But I actually did start out with an electronic logbook, a Windows-based logbook, oh, my Lord, long time ago. And, you know, some people believe that when you go to an electronic logbook, that means, oh, my gosh, I've got to go back to square one and put in every hour I've ever flown into my electronic logbook? No, actually, not really. In fact, Ken and I were talking about that a couple of weeks ago. It's like what I did recently when I finished up one piece of an electronic logbook. And I, because I was traveling so much, I kept a little paper one just in my travel kit. But I just said, starting from this point, I have this many hours in, you know, single-engine airplanes and multi-engine airplanes. I carried it forward into the new logbook and showed all the time that it got me to where I am. And people went, oh, yeah, okay, that works. Because all they're looking for is order, really, when it comes to numbers. And again, it just has to make sense to the examiner, and they just have to be able to prove that you meet the requirements for a flight test or, as Ken said, the currency. And boy, I got to tell you, when it comes time for an insurance breakdown at the beginning of the year, I have to be honest, I'm a pilot partner customer. So I've been playing with it for a while, too, and it does some cool stuff. But boy, insurance time, you go boop, 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 and it prints something out, and I give it to the insurance lady, and she goes, oh, okay. Because that used to be a nightmare trying to go back and figure all that kind of stuff out, because the insurance companies always seem to want data in different order and in different categories than the way I kept it. Hmm. It's kind of a long answer to a short question.
Ken, is it fair to say that before you formed Pilot Partner that you were a private pilot, you have some background in software and development and that sort of thing? And what, you had an idea or you saw a problem with what was available at that time? What was the process?
Well, Pilot Partner started back in 1997 when I was a 20-year-old kid just starting to learn to write software. And my dad's friend came in and gave me a flight in a general aviation airplane, some fancy little red airplane, which later turned out to be a Beech Dagger Wing, which is a heck of a first general aviation flight. So I landed from that flight and went right to the flight school and said, sign me up. I got to learn how to fly. So started my flight training, and being a brand new software developer who really didn't know that I was way too young and naive to start a software package, started writing my own database to track my logbook. Because back in 97, there was maybe one out in the market, and it just didn't feel right to me. So I wrote it just for myself and showed it to my flight instructor, and he looked at it and goes, this is really good. If you polish it up a little bit, you could probably sell it. So I polished it up and started to sell it, and it hit the market, and I sold like 2,500 copies of it over 2 or 3 years, right, enough to cover my private pilot's license and then some. Then I kind of let it die off. I even lost a copy of my own software, and I stopped using it about 10 years later during one of my long breaks from flying. And about two and a half years ago now, I decided to start it up again. Just now that I've been writing software for 20 years, it was something I wanted to do to bring it back, because I noticed that the electronic logbook market got divided into two categories. There's a couple quality options on the market that are very expensive, or there's low-end options that just, again, didn't feel right to me. Hmm. So I started working nights and weekends to build Pilot Partner, and I'm still working nights and weekends on Pilot Partner and writing software for big companies during the day. And it's just a passion that I love, and I'm trying to bring a quality software package at a reasonable price, because at the end of the day, I love logbooks, I love my product, but it's not worth more than $30 a year to me. And that's how I came up with the pricing model. It wasn't because I calculated it out and said, if I get a certain number of people to sign up, I'll be rich one day. It's because that's the most I can justify a logbook is worth compared to an hour of flight time or 10 gallons of avgas or those other things that provide what I consider those high value of why we're here. It's a logbook. It's something you need. It's something that's valuable, but $30 a year is what it's worth.
I imagine you wrote the second iteration of this in a different language than you used back in the 90s.
That's true. The first version was written in Visual Basic 6 for anybody who is techie-based, using an Access database. And when someone ordered it, I stuck four 3.5-inch floppies into my machine, burned it, stuck a label on it, and mailed it to them. And now it's all web-based. It's using modern microservices technology, and it works on the web, and there is a native Android, iOS, and iPad app available to use Pilot Partner with.
Hey Ken, just curious, what was the price of the original product?
The original product was, I want to say it was $50. And being physical software, it was a license. We had no maintenance fees or contracts. And basically, once web became more prevalent, we offered updates via the web.
Yes, it's still very reasonable.
Yep. I still know, I have confirmed there are two people who are still using the original version and will not switch over.
There's always a few of those holdouts. Ken, where does the data reside? Where does the database live? Does it live locally on the user's machine or somewhere else? I'm thinking about things like backup and recovery and, that's hard drive crashes and things like that. I guess that would be an issue for any kind of electronic logbook solution.
Backups and data loss is just a matter of who do you want to be responsible for it. So with Pilot Partner, we are cloud-based, and all your data resides in the cloud. I'm a Microsoft engineer, so I use Microsoft Azure to host the service, and Azure does redundancy and backups and data protection for us, and we use a lot of their geo-redundant databases and backup strategies there to protect your data. But I'm very concerned about once you host your data on a provider's service, what does that mean to you as the customer? Because it's your data. It's not Pilot Partner's data. So we do several things to give an extra layer of protection to our customers. The first thing we do is your data is always accessible to you in an export file, even if your account is expired and you do not want to renew your subscription. Be sad to see you go, but it's your data. You can always export your data 2, 3, 4 years after your subscription expires. You can get an Excel spreadsheet or a CSV sheet of your flight so you can take it someplace else. The other thing we offer is a printout version, which will format just like the standard paper logbooks. You can click print and your information, including your flight instructor signatures and endorsements, will be printed so you can bind it and present it as a traditional paper logbook at a flight review or a check ride or even a airline interview and present it in a professional format that everything is nice and tidy, everything adds up, and there's no chicken scratch or anything hard to read.
And they don't even make whiteout anymore anyway, do they?
Yeah, they do. They absolutely.
Oh, do they?
Oh, yeah. You can still find that. Yeah.
I didn't know that. But
still trying to figure out how to get off my iPhone. You know, I can't. It's messed up the screen.
Yeah, it does that. Ken, what about something? You have something called the CFI dashboard. Do CFIs have a different kind of logbook requirement than just people who are not flight instructors? Or what's the dashboard all about?
So I think flight instructors have a unique challenge. Now, flight instructors get divided in a couple different categories. Some work for large flight schools who have training management systems who are usually painful to use but do the job. But what I saw in the market was people like my flight instructor who taught me how to fly and several instructors I've used since is the independent flight instructor. there are requirements from the FAA that they maintain records of the training that they've provided. So not only are they signing the student's logbook to say, I took them out and did stalls and turns and slow flight, and they've met the requirements for the rating that they were seeking, they have to maintain those records themselves. Because if you fast forward several years, if there's an accident and the lawyers want to get involved, that flight instructor may get called in to say, yes, I did provide the training. The other issue that I've had is similar to what you asked Rob earlier about, what was it? How did you learn how to do your logbook? My experience was actually an issue. My first 10 flights or so before I soloed, my experience was I flew, I handed my logbook to my instructor, he filled it out, he wrote some note in the little 1-inch square that was available to him, I closed it and went home. My instructor forgot what he wrote. I probably never went back and read it. And then comes time for my first solo. I land from my first solo. I'm right in that endorphin high of flying an airplane by myself for the first time, which is both super scary and exciting all at the same time. And I get out of the airplane. I hand my logbook to my instructor. He goes, no, you are pilot in command. You log it. I'm like, what's this logging thing? What do I write where? What am I supposed to write in the remarks field? I was completely unprepared, and there was no training provided for that. So the CFI dashboard is, it started with that concept of let's change the way we log instructional flights. The CFI dashboard allows an instructor to electronically link to their students' logbooks. So one, when they go home at the end of the day, the instructor has a complete history of all the flights that that student has done, whether he flew with that instructor or previous instructors. How nice would it be to see the notes of those previous flights with different instructors? And if the student goes on vacation for 2 weeks and comes home sick for another 2 weeks and the weather's bad for a month and finally calls back 3 months later, say, I'm ready for my next flight, how's that instructor supposed to be prepared to do what that student needs on that next flight? With Pilot Partner CFI dashboard, that instructor can simply load the dashboard, look at where that student was by looking at the remarks from the previous flights, and choose a flight plan that makes the most sense for that next student, that student's next flight.
That's fascinating. So the flight instructor has visibility into the logbooks of their students.
Correct. Up until the point that the student says, I no longer want to fly with this person, the student owns the data. They can turn that link off with one checkbox. So then with the CFI dashboard, I started thinking, well, what else does a flight instructor need? I'm not a flight instructor yet. It is definitely on my short list to put the time in to study and earn that rating, because that's, I enjoy teaching a lot. I just choose to add features to Pilot Partner instead of study to be a CFI right now. And it's not something I want to do halfway. But other things that I think an instructor has a challenge with is we rolled out this great new ACS program, which, again, I applaud the FAA and the people who worked hard to do that, because that really makes sense. So what we've done is loaded the ACS, every section of the ACS, into what we call the Aviation Training Board, which is divided into four columns: not introduced, introduced, progressing, and ready for check ride. So take the first skill, pre-flight. When the instructor has introduced that to their student, they drag it from not introduced to introduced and move those along as they progress through the training program. What this allows the instructor to do is see at a glance where the student is within the training program. And I predict that if used properly, you can save 1 to 2 flights in a total training program, saving the student $200, $300, $400 to earn their private pilot's license.
And we should mention, too, ACS stands for Airman Certification Standards, that kind of replace the old
PTS.
PTS. No, I thought that's what I have when I can't remember. Or is that?
That's PTSD.
Oh, PTSD. C? Okay. No, but anyway.
Turning this into the acronym show.
Yes. Well, it's aviation after all, so it gets hard to avoid. Ken, I think you know that David and I have another podcast we do every week, the UAV Digest. In fact, I think you're a bit of a flyer yourself of the unmanned sort. Any possibility of us seeing a logbook for unmanned aircraft?
I have considered it on multiple occasions and have thought about doing it, but I'm about to, part of my day job, go to work for a company in the unmanned aerial vehicle industry. So I think in order to keep this separate, I'm not going to go that direction with Pilot Partner at this time.
Okay. I was kind of hopeful because that's a requirement, I think, that is going to grow in importance for drone flyers.
The interesting thing about the unmanned aerial systems is the software that goes along with most modern drones out there, which is a term I have a hard time saying, but is becoming more the way you refer to them. The software is going to have the built-in logs. And for an external system like Pilot Partner to be an effective login system, I think it's going to be a manual step that's just not value add. I will say I do have a couple drone pilots who have adopted Pilot Partner to be their logbook of record. So it can be done. It's just not the market that we're going to go down at this time.
Okay.
But, you know, something I will tell you is that Ken's really good about listening to ideas. In fact, for the CFI dashboard, I gave him one that, well, actually, he didn't take, I don't think. Remember, Ken, when I said that when instructors opened the CFI dashboard, it would say, wow, you're an instructor. You're a really cool guy. You didn't put that in, did you?
Just wait until next week's release, Rob.
Okay.
We'll see if it makes it.
Max, doesn't that sound really neat to you?
I'm sitting here laughing, smiling. You're cracking me up, Rob.
What I'm really trying to make the CFI dashboard a central part of Pilot Partner, because I think instructors have a hard job, and I just don't think there's enough tools available to make instructing easy, at least the sideline activities of instructing easy, so you can focus on what you do best is teach people how to fly. So CFI dashboard is free for flight instructors. I have a company mission to never take a dollar from an active flight instructor.
You value your life, obviously.
That I do. And I now need my checkout once a year, so I need to keep my flight instructors happy.
Yeah, don't try and take food away from us either. It's easier. No. We'll bite.
Yes. So we work off of a referral program. So the dashboard is free for flight instructors to use. So if you have a student who's using Pilot Partner, you can access their Pilot Partner logbook through the dashboard, use the electronic signature system, and use that completely free. Now, you need a subscription to have your logbook in Pilot Partner, but for every student that you refer, the instructor gets 6 months of Pilot Partner subscription, and there's no max time. There's no cutoffs. There's everything rolls over. So if you refer 10 students, you have the next 5 years for free. So it's a really low bar to basically have free Pilot Partner. And we've been known to, if a flight instructor contacts us, say, hey, my subscription's about to run out, we'll extend it for you. I'm actually contemplating just eliminating the whole referral program here pretty soon. And just if you can prove that you're a flight instructor, it's yours for free.
Brilliant.
But, you know, there is one other aspect of this that seriously I think is worth mentioning. Ken was being nice before when he said that it can be difficult for instructors sometimes to remember exactly what they did with each student on a particular day. And honestly, having been a student of many years over the years, there's nothing worse than an instructor coming up and seeing you walk in the room going, what'd we do last time? was it you that I did this, that, whatever with? And you go, no, that wasn't me. Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, what did we do then?
And what's your name?
Yeah, you know, it really, I think this could certainly, this kind of thing really enhances the overall training experience for everybody, the instructor and the student.
Let me ask about one thing that's important in logbooks we haven't talked about, and that's endorsements. There was a meeting recently here between the FAA and CFIs and DPEs, which is the fancy FAA word for pilot examiners. And it came out that one of the big issues that some of the DPEs felt was an issue was people who have an old logbook. They started, you know, they did a few flights 20 years ago. Maybe they got a solo endorsement. They quit. They came back. They go for their check ride. And now that solo endorsement that was printed in the back of the logbook 20 years ago no longer meets the current phraseology for, you know, a solo endorsement. And so they have said, well, that's then invalid. Now, as flight instructors, we all live and breathe and die by the AC61-65F, which is the latest version after E, and it's the kind of the latest way that all these endorsements should be phrased. So I'm guessing, Ken, how do you handle endorsements, and how do you handle endorsements that change over time in terms of the way the FAA phrases them?
We have two ways to handle endorsements in Pilot Partner. The first way is if you have endorsements in an existing paper logbook, it's as simple as taking a picture of it and attaching it to your Pilot Partner logbook. Now that's part of your electronic record. So if your paper logbook is stolen, burns up, walks away, you can recover it. Then we also have an endorsement wizard, which is preloaded with all the templates that we have. And we've worked with NAFI, National Association of Flight Instructors, to loosely use their endorsement templates for all the common endorsements that you have. So it's as simple as calling up, I need a solo endorsement, and you can review the text, change the text that's a part of the actual endorsement if you don't agree with the template. Other than that, you fill in the blanks, sign it, and then now that is your endorsement. We also have a system that will track those endorsements that expire. Your solo endorsement is typically good for 90 days. And as soon as you sign that endorsement, based upon the date that you say the endorsement is signed, a counter will start to alert both the student and the instructor that before you dispatch your student on their next solo flight, you may need to issue a new endorsement. As far as handling the issue of if an endorsement changes, I'm very much of the mind of once something is signed, it's locked down. You can't change that. So now it's an issue of alerting the instructor and the student that maybe there's a newer version of this endorsement template available. And I'll be honest, I don't think we have a silver bullet solution for that problem yet, but that's the great thing about a platform like Pilot Partner is as new problems emerge in the industry, it's really easy to code in a solution for it. Something that we did recently was a comprehensive IFR currency calculator that took into account the new rules with basic aviation training devices and advanced aviation training devices, otherwise known as simulators. There is no other electronic logbook on the market that will correctly calculate your IFR currency using the 2-month and 6-month rule or combined simulator and real airplane for your IFR currency.
All right. Well, fascinating conversation. I've certainly learned an awful lot about pilot logbooks. Ken, is there anything else that you wanted to mention before we move on to some other topics?
No, just give us a try when you get a chance. And, you know, we offer a 60-day free trial for all pilots. And if you have a CFI instructor number when you sign up and you enter that, you will be advanced a 6-month free trial for being a CFI. And also, we would like to offer for any Airplane Geeks listener a promo code that will give you 18 months for the price of 12 months. So that's 18 months of Pilot Partner for $29.95. And the promo code is AirplaneGeeks18. It's all one word and the number 18 at the end of it. So AirplaneGeeks18.
Oh, thanks, Ken. That's very, very kind, very generous. We appreciate that. If we can bring some value to our listeners, that's a great thing.
Do we feel like we need to spell out Airplane Geeks just in case some of our listeners don't quite? Okay, maybe not. All right, I'm just wondering.
Okay.
Never mind.
All right. Ken, thanks again for coming on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the invite.
G'day, Max, David, Max, Brian, and Rob. It's Ray Davis from Sydney, Australia here. Just wanted to send a quick shout out to you guys, wishing you a very Merry Christmas and a very happy and safe 2017 to both you and your families. He's hoping for a bigger and brighter year next year for you all, as well as the Airplane Geeks community out there. And love the podcast and can't wait to see what you guys have got installed for next year. So until then, stay safe, keep the blue side up, light tailwinds, as we say down here, down under, cav okay to you all. Cheerio.
All right, again, this is our last episode for 2016. No show next week. That would be the episode that would come out December 28th. Our next episode will be the first week in January. As we mentioned, I think last time, if you'd like to record some of your thoughts about 2016, some of the aviation highlights or lowlights, or if you'd like to look ahead to 2017 and speculate as to what's going to be in the news or what might be important to follow, then go ahead and record something and send it to us. Try to keep it under 5 minutes. That would be the best. You can send it to the geeks at airplanegeeks.com. If you need to put it up on Dropbox or some other system like that, just let us know. And if you're going to submit something, please get it to us, well, before the ball drops, New Year's Eve. Try to get it to us in before the end of December. We'd appreciate that. All right, David, anything for all of us and the listeners?
Well, to be honest, I'm sure everybody knows by now that I went and saw that movie over the weekend for Rogue One. So I have a review. It has some spoilers in it. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, wait. But we'll have a link to the show notes to the review. Overall, I thought it was an amazing movie and better than I liked Episode 7 last year. And it makes my favorite movie, Star Wars, get 2 hours longer. So you can never have enough Star Wars. But definitely Rogue One, if you're an airplane geek and you like the ships and spaceships and the war part of Star Wars, it's definitely the movie to see.
So, David, out of a possible 5 props, how many would you give it?
5 out of 5.
5 out of 5. All right. Well, that's an endorsement.
And, David, who was the director of that? Was it J.J. Abrams again?
Gareth Edwards.
Okay. Okay.
Rob, what's new in your world?
Well, I think today I was going to say something about the fact we were just hanging around doing nothing this whole week, and I got this nice piece of news this morning from the folks at FeedSpot that said they're the RSS feed people on a lot of websites and blogs that they named us in the top 50 aviation blogs on the planet. We made the first 25, so I guess that's a good sign. And it's always nice to get a little unexpected pat on the back, especially at Christmas time. So my kudos to my editor, Scott Spangler, who works pretty hard to keep me out of trouble.
Yeah, and that's a full-time task, I bet.
It is, actually. And what I have found that my jokes don't translate very well to the print version. So.
Well, congratulations to you, Rob, to Scott Spangler, and to Jetwine. Way to go.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, great. Max West, how about you? What's going on in your world?
Well, today was kind of an interesting day. It was I didn't have any flights scheduled. I had a dental appointment. I went. I was off getting a Starbucks afterwards, and lo and behold, I get a note from one of our Slack listeners, Jet City Star, who said it's going to land at San Jose in the next hour. And I thought, wow, I need to grab my camera and zip on down there. And it is something that we have talked about on multiple shows dating back to episode 67 in 2009. We talked about it most recently in episode 421 back in September, and it is the Mitsubishi MRJ regional jet, which, of course, is the first airliner designed by Japan in about 50 years. And there are four flight test versions of this that have been built, and they're being shuttled up to or ferried up to Moses Lake in Washington, where they'll be doing flight testing for the next 12 to 18 months. And the third of the fourth ones came through San Jose today. It came in for, via Guam and then Hawaii and then San Jose, and it's already landed up at Moses Lake this evening. So I zipped on down there and went scurrying all over the airport. Couldn't really see it very well because it just, you know, happened to be behind a very long row of hangars. So I went up on the top of the short-term parking garage, which had a view over the terminal from the opposite end of the airport. And there I spotted it well hidden behind a Signature's building. So I went and positioned myself to take some photographs, got some great pictures of it as it was taxiing and then taking off. So it was kind of fun to you know, see this next generation airliner. It's got the new GE engines. I don't want to tell you this.
No,
it was really nice and quiet. You know, I could barely hear the thing.
No, those are not GE engines.
Oh, aren't they?
No. Those are Pratt & Whitney geared turbofans.
Okay, then I guess Jet City Star's been messing with me.
He was messing with you. I'll have to have a little talk with that exactly. With that guy. Yeah. So how was the sound? Was it pretty quiet?
You know, it's kind of hard to tell because it was so light. That thing just popped up and was gone. It was, you know, they probably had 10 people on board, and you know, it climbed like crazy. But it was interesting to see the livery is totally different than the livery of the first one or two flight tests that went up there. There's a picture that we linked to in the Seattle Times in September, which has got a dark blue trim, and this has got an orange trim. So I was kind of surprised that they've got different livery on them. Of course, this is just you know, the test livery. They'll have different ones when they deliver to the customers, and the big customer will be SkyWest, which has bought 100 of them.
Yeah, but they do that color trim thing for a reason. It makes it easier on the pilots because they just say, Max T, you're going to go test out the green airplane today.
Exactly.
And you, Rob, you take the red one. And see, then we can't screw it up.
Well, I'm sure we could, but
unless if you're colorblind.
Well, there is that, yeah, but then we're not supposed to be flying anyway.
Exactly.
So we'll have a photo in the show notes that you took, Max T. This is a great shot. This is a nice shot. Another photo we're going to have in the show notes is Brian getting into the holiday spirit. Brian, you sent it along, so it's going in the show notes.
Yeah, no, I think that we should all get a holiday photo and put it in the show notes. But I was fortunate enough to represent the Airplane Geeks along with Micah, the Plane Talking UK guys, did a Christmas mashup extravaganza, and they haven't released the video on YouTube yet, but the show's going to be on YouTube, and everyone was in holiday garb, so I have my Airplane Geeks button on and was representing the geek, so really really happy to have participated in that. Another photo I want to get you is of the new United Club at Los Angeles Airport in Terminal 7. They opened up this massive lounge, and yeah, there's an outdoor observation deck, which is really cool, a huge bar for both food and adult beverages and all, and tons of seating. And United did a really great job. And supposedly this is how they're going to model all the rest of their clubs as they, you know, revamp them throughout the network. And so hats off to United for doing a spectacular job with the new redesign of the club.
Great. All right. A few emails from listeners. First, one from Mark Newton. Actually, we heard from him on a couple of topics. The first one, though, is a video. This is man creates a model A-10 Warthog that burts Nerf balls on strafing runs. So this is a really nice looking and fairly large A-10 RC airplane. And what he's done is he's fitted a sort of a Nerf gun into the nose of this thing that shoots little Nerf balls that sounds, I don't know, kind of a little bit like how the real A-10 gun sounds. So we'll have that video in the show notes. It's kind of fun. I think it's kind of cool.
Well, and you know where this is shot, right?
Yeah, this was near you, wasn't it?
Well, only in Silicon Valley would you find nerds with enough time to put Nerf balls inside RC models. Yeah, this was shot out, I could tell by looking at it, at the Baylands, which is a very beautiful, nice RC flying area, about 2 miles from Moffett Field. So it's, I hope that doesn't get shut down someday because it's very close to, two major airports, but it's a beautiful place to fly RC airplanes.
Cool. We also heard from Ian. He sent us a news item. This is Chatham Islands resident has World War II flying boat in backyard. And there's a video in this news report. This is from newshub.co.nz, which is probably NZ if you're of that persuasion. But he notes that it's an interesting story of an ex-Royal New Zealand Air Force Sunderland that this guy has in their backyard at the Chatham Islands, which are near New Zealand. This guy is quite a character. As I said, the video is kind of fun to watch, but he has this old hulk of a flying boat that he's got along with some other interesting aircraft and memorabilia.
Yeah, he must have a pretty big backyard to fit that in.
Yeah, I think he's got some. Actually, he built a building around this thing. So that it's protected. Link to that in the show notes. Then a follow-up email from Mark Newton. This is concerning our conversation about allowing or not phone calls on airplanes. And he says, serious question, why would phone calls on airplanes be any worse than phone calls on trains?
I say they're not any worse and they both should be banned.
Yeah. But it does seem kind of similar. So phone calls are allowed on trains. I mean, maybe your proximity to your fellow passengers on an airplane is maybe a little bit closer. I'm not sure.
And depending on the train, you might be able to move.
And go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but it's an interesting question. It kind of makes you think a little bit. So one final item before we close out. Have we got some kind of breaking news going on here?
Oh, I've got to tell Rob. Hey, did you see it? This has happened as we were talking down here. And you and I are both excited about everything Cirrus. They just delivered the first one tonight as we were talking.
I heard about that.
Isn't that awesome?
It really is. And
what did they deliver?
A Cirrus Vision Jet. The first
the Vision
one.
Jet.
Yeah, the way the Diamond Jet's going to go someday.
Yep. The first customer delivery was presented this evening. First prototype flew in 2008, so that's not too bad. So I figure probably about a 10-year development process. And they've got about 600 of these that are on the backlog. And, pretty darn cool to have a relatively low-cost, $2 million single-engine jet available.
Very cool.
Well, especially when you consider the fact that the company went through some pretty difficult financial times in the middle. And they really didn't have that much downtime before the Chinese company bought them out and gave them the cash to finish the Vision Jet.
So what do you think? You want to get your type rating? I know I want to get mine.
Yeah, I'd settle for that. Of course, I don't know. I was out flying the Eclipse jet about a month or so ago. Kind of like that, too. Two motors.
I've got that type rating already.
In other words, we should be expecting this in 4 years to be like Skycatchers and they'll be into the chopping block.
Don't say that.
Ouch.
Oh, dear. That's a terrible thought.
You've done a podcast way too long when you have aircraft coming and going.
Yeah.
We've witnessed the first flight of the A380 and now it's almost ended production. We've witnessed the first flight of Skycatcher and it's being scrapped. It is kind of frightening the amount of time or how short-lived a lot of these fantastic projects we were so interested with in years ago are suddenly evaporating, or am I just tanker becoming way too soon?
And Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what? I still am so impressed when people have the wherewithal to take something that is just a concept in their brain and turn it into something that someone can really use. Yeah, they don't all work. You're right. But boy, there's a lot of cool stuff out there.
And this is pretty. This really, I mean, the colors on this thing, it's really well done.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We want to thank all of you for listening to us. Our guest this episode was Ken Viard, President of Pilot Partner. Ken, tell our listeners once again where they can find more about Pilot Partner.
Find us at pilotpartner.net, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, under Pilot Partner, and we have a YouTube channel if you search for Pilot Partner. Includes a lot of our training videos, which you may hear a familiar voice behind some of those training videos, and some just other exciting flight videos that I've posted there on our YouTube channel.
Hey, you know, I did look at some of those, Ken, and one of the ones I liked was you had some video from Oshkosh. I think, was that this year's Oshkosh, all the landings?
That was this year's. Yeah, that was the one where we were standing on the flight line. It was actually broadcasted live on Periscope, and I was able to also get it up on Facebook. It was a fun 4 or 5 minutes, and I was actually standing in front of, I think it was a guest on your podcast that you had recently. I hope it wasn't the other podcast I'm thinking of.
Either way's okay.
The thing I liked about that is that I've never been to Oshkosh, or maybe I should phrase it, I have not yet been to Oshkosh. And, of course, we've talked with plenty of folks who have explained the huge number of airplanes that come in and land in the sort of the process of managing all that safely. And this video really shows you what's involved. I mean, how many airplanes are coming in, how fast they're coming in. You know, you hear the directions that the pilots are being given as to, you know, where to land and what to do afterwards. And the pace of it is just phenomenal. I've never seen anything like that at all. It really gives you a good sense for just what's taking place there at Oshkosh. So thanks for putting that up.
And well, of course, for that 1 week of the year, Oshkosh Whitman Field becomes the busiest airport in the world.
That's right. Yep.
Also, keep in mind what you were watching and listening to was half of the airport. There was a whole nother runway that was just as crazy going on at the exact same time.
Amazing. Amazing. So we'll put a link to that one in the show notes as well. So y'all take a look at that. It's pretty spectacular. All right, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/432. You'll find on our homepage links to all the places you can find us on social media, how to get in touch with us, and so forth. We want to thank our co-hosts for another year of great podcasting. First off, Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine, a flight instructor, and publisher of the award-winning Jetwine blog.
Yeah, cool. Wow. I'm just not used to hearing that, but yeah, it was pretty nice. And it's been 2016. Wow. It just can't be that long, but I guess it is, which means that I must have started doing this back when I was 26.
Right.
Yeah. Or so.
All right. And folks can find you online at jetwine.com and other places as well.
Yeah, flyingmag.com and the weekly news or the biweekly newsletters up there. And biweekly means every other week. No, I mean twice a week. That's semi-weekly, isn't it?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. The circular references in the dictionary.
Come on, guys.
Twice a week.
Okay, it comes out twice a week. plus the flying magazines on the stand, and of course the stuff that goes on up at Jetwine.
All right, and also co-hosting has been Max Trescott, our other certified flight instructor, our CFI. Max is also an author, and he knows more than just about anybody else when it comes to glass cockpits.
The other Max. Hey, I just can't believe all the really cool stuff we've talked about tonight. This has been a fun show just covering the broad range of stuff we've been done. And so on that note, I want to invite everybody to come back next year, and we'll keep doing it. So we're having a lot of fun. Hope our listeners are as well, too. You can find me on Twitter. I just posted a couple of photos that I took of the MRJ Mitsubishi jet. You can find me on Facebook, or you can, if you want to fly when you're here in the Bay Area with me, go to SJ, short for SanJoseFlight.com.
Great. Thank you. And also David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, our military aviation expert. It's been a great year to have you with us and contribute all the amazing information and knowledge that you can provide. David, thank you.
You're just sucking up because I have to put up with you on Thursday.
Yeah.
No, it's been a good year. It's nice to have gone through a whole year without having to worry about things like surgery. So I appreciate all of our listeners, and I appreciate our new growing Slack team. Our Slackers are growing leaps and bounds, and our co-hosts really need to get involved with that more. Hint, 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 Trescott, Brian, and Rob. And looking forward to 2017.
Great. And also Brian Coleman. He's the guy that spends so much time, well, scheduling guests and doing Skype pre-checks and getting all that organized. Really appreciate it. It's a great contribution, Brian. We want to thank you for that. And it really takes some of the load, a significant amount of load off of others. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. I don't think I'll ever be able to understand how you've been able to do this for 8 years. Just the quantity of time that you put into it. It's just amazing. So thank you for being the inspiration behind all this and keeping us going. And I look forward to having more time next year to dedicate to doing this. And I can't believe that I'm going to say this, but I really hope that I don't fly quite as much next year as I did this year. And I really look forward to spending more time on the show and at air shows and doing field reporting and meetups and all the other really spectacular things that we get to do. This is so much fun to do. And it's just a privilege for me to be working with you guys. So thank you very much.
Well, who knows? Maybe 2017 will be the year that we all get to meet up at Oshkosh.
Could be. Could be.
Never know.
Never know. Never knew.
Thank you to all the listeners. Boy, we wouldn't be here doing this if it wasn't for them putting up with them. Okay, putting up with me. All right. All right. I know you guys were going to say that. So I just thought I
preempted that.
Yeah, I just preempted
it. And actually, following along on that, what we're planning on doing is in the first episode of January is providing you all with feedback on the listener survey that we had conducted over the course of the last few months. It's very interesting results, and we'll be presenting some of that to you all.
Max, I also get to announce the winner of the Living in the Age of Airplanes giveaway. We have the DVD and Blu-ray disc that Brian Twilliger signed and donated to the show. So if you haven't sent in a submission for that, please send an email to the Airplane Geeks and we'll put you in the hat and we'll randomly draw a name for Blu-ray or DVD.
Right. Make sure the subject of your email is Living in the Age of Airplanes. And finally, we want to thank all the guests that we've had this year in 2016. We've just had an enormous number of really fascinating guests, a lot of different topics, different subjects, a wide variety, I think, which is part of what we're all about. It's the passion of aviation, regardless of what kind of aviation or the topic within aviation. So we want to thank all of our guests. All right, so with that, we'll finish it up. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his work at brunomassone.com. So please join us again, well, next year, as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Happy holidays.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
That's a wrap.
Yay.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a good holiday, guys. It was nice chatting this year, and I'll get better next year. I promise.
And that takes the fun out of it.
Yeah.
You got it. You guys be good. See ya.
All right.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.